Thank you, Rose. My name is Stanley, and I'm a grateful recovering addict. I don't know whether to pick this up or pull it down. Let's get comfy. You know, it is a real pleasure to be here and share with you guys this evening. So thank you for asking me along to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. I feel moved and touched to be here. I've got so much to share with you. He said to me, do you mind sharing for 40 minutes? I said, man, that's no problem. I got plenty to say, you know. Firstly, I want to say I give thanks and praise to my higher power, man, for bringing me here today. You know, my life is full. You know, my heart's full. Today, I'm a grown, mature adult sitting in front of you today who's going to share my experience, strength, and hope and what I've learned along the way on this journey. I came into recovery at the age of 23 years. Battered, bruised, broken, lost, confused, you know, and a rife addict, you know. I knew no other way of living. I lived to use and I used to live. You know, I used from a very, very young early age, I started using when I was 10 years of age. And, you know, today sometime I look back and I reflect and I think, you know, wow, it's a long time ago. You know, I'm going to go through my story, basically. I'm going to introduce you to myself. Some of you here know me and some of you don't. I'm going to start at the beginning. You know, I grew up in a very dysfunctional family. Unfortunately, my mum suffers from schizophrenia. It was a very hardcore disease back in them days in the 70s. Because there was no help, there was no support, there was necessarily not really any treatment except locking my mum up, basically. As a result of that, me and my sisters were in and out of care all our lives, children's homes and foster parents. The children's home became my home plenty of times. They knew us by our first names, you know, and it became a home for us, you know. And again, back then, there wasn't a lot of black foster parents, so I was mostly fostered with white people. And again, that was an experience for me as a kid growing up, as a young black kid growing up in the 70s. I went through some wars, some hardcore wars, before I actually started picking up and using. Upon reflection, you know, when I first kind of used, for me, you know, when I look on using, that obsessive compulsive behavior, yeah? Once I start, I can't stop. I can remember being like 6, 7 years old, playing with, you know, toys or whatever, and getting up to mischief, you know, And I would always want to go that extra mile. You know, everyone else was happy to call it a day. No, it's time to go in. Look, we got to go in, you know. But no, let's stay out a little later, man. You know, let's climb that wall and jump that fence and raid that bloody plum tree. You know, I always wanted to go that extra mile. So, you know, when I did start to use, you know, and my using flourished within me, and I turned to my first drug of choice was weed. Again, because my mum wasn't present mentally and spiritually and emotionally, you know, myself and my sisters, we were allowed to, you know, just run astray, so I could get away with staying out late. I could get away with running up and down on the streets. I could get away with not going to school, you know, and this became my life, just being a vagabond, so to speak, you know, just roaming around on the streets. And I can remember at the age of about 8 or 9, I met some Rastafarians. And they took me underneath their wing, you know, and they saw this kid running up and down the street, and they said to me, where's your mum? You know, and I made up some stories, as you do, you know. I lied because I was ashamed. I was ashamed of my mum's condition. And they used to play football on Stoke Newton Common on a regular basis, so they would tell me to come down, and I did. And they took me into their family. They taught me about Rastafari. They taught me about a spiritual being. You know, and they taught me discipline and boundaries. And, you know, later on in my life, they came back to me when I came into this fellowship. Basically, when these guys took me underneath their wing, they became another family for me. You know, I went on a different journey again, you know, and weed opened up a whole new door of using for me. Where before I started off with the cigarettes and, you know, other bits and bobs, when I started to smoke weed and putting it on the bong at the age of 10, that was it. I was on my way to, you know, to greater things that I didn't realize I was on my way to, if that makes sense. You know, I'd opened the door, basically. And that was it. I was on my journey. I can remember being the age of like 11, 12, and I was in children's homes, and, you know, one guy I remember brought in some speed, and, you know, we started experimenting with it, you know, as we do. And again, I was introduced to this hardcore drug. Again, I started, you know, smoking weed, you know, getting on the bong, because back then you used to make it up in a jam jar bottle and this big ass long pipe with a lot of water. And if you pull too hard, you got water down your throat, you drown yourself. And I nearly drowned myself a few times. And, you know, I'm sharing my experience of what it was like for me to use. And at such a young age, now as an adult at 36, when I think, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, you know, what the hell was going on for this kid, you know, to be doing this to himself, you know? I went through my criminal ways, you know, I hung out with criminal minded people and I done some criminal things. Hence, I ended up in detention center. Hence, I ended up in youth YCs, and then on to obviously the male prisons. And I can remember the first time that I was sentenced to detention center, because I had got so used to being fostered and in out of care, for me it was just another part of the journey. I remember sitting in the bus on the way down to Halinzi Bay and looking forward to it, you know, looking forward to it, because I knew that I was gonna be fed. I heard there's gonna be some cows and sheep and all this kind of stuff that I've never seen, you know, because I've never been on holiday in my life at that point, you know. And it was exciting. And when I did arrive, I was amongst, you know, a whole house full of other guys just like me. Rebellious, broken homes, dysfunctional families, and we got on like a house on fire. And I had some, without bigging it up, but some of them moments were really good moments of my life, without sounding too whatever. But I'm being honest. I'm being totally honest with you here. And the reason why is because, again, as I said, I didn't have a proper family upbringing. Food was very rare. Many a times, me and my sisters would have to drink water to fill our bellies up, you know, because mum wasn't there to provide us with food. So when I arrived in these institutions and they threw food at me, and you got custard and cake and, you know, afters as well on top of that, it, you know, for this kid, it was a really big thing, a really big thing. So for me, the institutions, the prisons and the jails didn't do what it was supposed to do for me, if that makes sense. You know, and it's why I'm telling you a little bit about myself before I get into that. But what it did do for me was this. When I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, I can remember I got a sentence of, like, I think it was 17 months or something like this. And I remember being up in Warren Hill, which is a prison for young offenders. And I went in there as a heroin addict. I remember clucking and whatnot, and I remember, you know, the guys were saying, don't say anything to the screws, don't say anything, you know, they will, you know, fraggle you off and fraggle rock and all this stuff, you know. So I didn't say anything, you know, and I went through my cold turkey, and when I arrived at the other side, I remember I said I would never, ever, ever take that shit again, never. And I went to the other side. I mean, I stopped smoking. I stopped taking butter. I stopped taking sugar. I stopped drinking coffee. I just went for it hardcore. You know, I went to the gym 24/7 and I became a real role model prisoner to the point where they asked me to run for the prison because I was that fit. You know, and I'm serious. I ran for the prison. You know, I went in there with, you know, as I said, you know, being bang on the gear, and I came out with medals and GCSE in maths and English and word processing and an A level in art. I got 98%. I'd done really well. I can remember, you know, sitting in my cell, and it was coming up to my EDR, which is my earliest date of release. And I was halfway through this, you know, this GCSE of my art exam. And it was coming up time for me to be released. And I didn't want to go. I did not want to go, man. Because I knew once I walked through that gate, I knew my chances of finishing that exam would have been very, very slim. Very slim. So I called one of the officers who I got on with and I sat him down. I said, listen, I can't go home. And he looked at me and he was like, what are you saying, Brownie? It's my surname, Brownie. Brownie is what they call you. You know, I said, I can't go home, man. You know, I need to finish this. I need to do this. And I remember that he put his key in the lock. You know, and he opened the door and he let the lock out so it wouldn't lock us both in, and he shut the door and he said, listen, son, he took off his hat and he spoke to me like a father. He said, man, look, it doesn't have to be this way, you know. You can do this. You can do this. You know, you don't have to be here to do it. You can do it out there. And right at that moment, I knew he did not know what I meant. And I could not be asked to explain to him. You know what I'm saying? I knew I had to take drastic measures. And I knew I had to survive because I've been surviving all my life. And that's one thing I'm good at. So I nodded and I hummed and I hummed. And then when he left, I think the very next day I went and had a punch up with a guy, lost my days, and I made it. I got an O level in art and I got 98%. And I'm telling you, when I think about, you know, as I'm talking with you, I'm remembering stuff I've done, I'm emotional, man. Honestly, I'm emotional. So if I start crying, it's not because, you know, I ain't happy. I'm happy. It's because I'm, you know, I'm grateful for being here today. As I said, I started using when I was 10. I used from 10 until I was 23. That's 13 years. Next month, I'm going to be 13 years clean. You know? Thank you very much. Thank you. And, you know, and that moves me because for 13 years, I've been living life on life's terms without the use of. You know, I have to learn how to be a man. Narcotics Anonymous has taken me by the hand and shown me how to live. I am so, so, so grateful. I was born and raised in Hackney all my life, and I still live in Hackney. I still live there. And when I say this, man, for me it's a powerful thing because I see friends and family who are still out there. And a couple of days ago, I was driving on a road in Hackney, and I saw this disabled, you know, they drive the disabled kind of like car, where it's not a car, but you know what I mean? It's like a mobile unit. And I see this girl on it, and I look at her and I recognize her. So I put the car in reverse and I way back. And I bip bip. And I said, are you? And she went, Stan. So I pulled over and I went over to her, man. And I hugged her and I was like, gosh, Jesus Christ, what happened, man? You know, and she told me about how her veins had collapsed, and you know, had she, you know, the effects of using basically. And as she was talking to me, she started scratching and slurring, and I knew she was still at it. And funny enough, I saw them just the other day, and she had another freight and others in the mobile on the road, looked like they were going to school, you know. And I just nodded my head, shook my head. I was like, hey, that's your journey, man. That's okay, you know. And, you know, I'm telling you this because this it's the realities, man, of where we come from. All of us here in this room. When I sat here while my friend was doing the chair, I was looking around at you, man, all of you. And you are me. You are me. And I am you. I see your pain. I see your pain in your eyes. I see your suffering. Your suffering, that's my suffering. I recognize it. When I pulled up outside this meeting, I never been to this meeting before. I never knew where it was. And I see a couple of fellas having a cigarette. I said, that's where the meeting is. Now, look how big Trafalgar Square is. How the hell did I pick out them two, man? Because my addict radar said, yeah, they're addicts, man. You know. My experience in recovery has been a very good experience. I kid you not. I've had 6 months to work the 12 steps. I've worked the 12 steps because the 12 steps freed Stanley to become who I am today. And I mean free. When I talk about, people talk about, you know, clean time. I talk about mean time, not clean time. For me, mean time is the most important thing, because it's in the meantime, while I'm being clean, what am I doing with myself? And in the meantime, I learned I had to work this program to the best of my ability. And that meant I had to work the 12 steps, every single one of them. And it took me 6 sponsors to do it. I remember coming to meetings and hearing people share. And I love every one of them. But when I hear the man who have the spiritual program, I just, like a magnet, man, I wanted that. Because I was sick and tired and fed up of being angry, resentful. Do you know what I'm saying? Fed up with it, man. And I wanted some peace in my life. I ain't into this thing about religion. Nah, man. For me, it's the spiritual program. That's what I embrace and I encompass in my life. And when I heard guys sharing the spiritual program and I spoke with them, they told me they had worked the 12 steps and they'd done a heck of a lot of service. So I got stuck in. But I have a story to tell before I got stuck into service. Because my first 2 years in recovery, I was spent floating about. You know as you do. You float. You go meetings. You punch a couple of cigarettes. Do you know what I mean? You get someone to buy you coffee, you know. And that's what I did. And I wasn't happy. I remember not feeling happy. I was like, nah, man, this ain't it. I ain't come so far for this. Something ain't right. I ain't happy. And I was close to going back. I was. And then I remember sitting in a meeting and I saw a flyer. And it said, show me how to live. World Convention in St. Louis. And I looked on that flyer and I said, I'm going to that fucking convention. Excuse my French. I said, I'm going. And I say it now because that's how I felt back then. Because I was so not here. I was desperate, man. Because I knew I'd found something good and I didn't want to lose it. And I knew I had to take drastic measures. And you know me, when it comes to that survival thing, man, I'm a survivor. Before I knew it, I had a ticket in my hand, and I was at the airport, and I was on a plane, and I arrived in St. Louis. Nowhere to stay, knew no one, only that there was a convention going on. And I turned up, and I remember sitting in a meeting. And I shared, you know, after a while listening to the Americans, you know, do their thing, you know, hallelujah. You know, they. I was like, whoa, hardcore. And I remember I thought, you know what, I don't know anybody here. Nobody don't know me, so I'm going to share. So when I put my hand up and I shared, and I bawled my eyes out, man. You know, I let it out because I was lost. As I said, I was lost. I was desperate. And I remember just really letting go, you know, not holding back, not editing. You know what I mean? When you share, when you just really let go. And afterwards, man, they all, you know, stood up and were applauding me for jumping on a plane and coming to St. Louis. And I was bawling my eyes out, and I remember I turned around and there was someone waiting to hug me. So I hugged him, went to sit down, and someone touched me and said, no, get up, son, and hug me too. And then as I went to sit down, there's no, another hug. When I looked, I went like that. And I kid you not, there was a whole line of addicts lining up to hug this guy from England. Because that's how they saw me, this guy from England. And they made me cry even more. And I cried, and I cried, and I cried. When I left St. Louis and I came back home, some of you know me and you probably remembers, I was a step Nancy, man. I got so into this, man, big time. I went straight into service. I got on HNI, PI, you know what I mean? Everything, you know, group service representative. I got stuck in, man, and I was preaching the steps, you know what I mean? And, you know, I took on their persona of, you know, hallelujah vibe. And, yeah, I went for it. And, you know, again, I'm a survivor. I needed to do that to save my ass because my ass was going out the door. And it saved me. And one by one, I worked them steps to the best of my ability with a pen and a paper. And I'm so grateful for the pen and the paper. And it's true. The pen is mightier than the sword. It's so, so true, man. When I wrote down every single step and I read it to my sponsors, you know, it made me realize how much stuff I had learned that was wrong. You know, coming to Narcotics Anonymous for me was like coming to school. I can use that analogy. My first year of recovery was like going on an access course. Do you know what I'm saying? You know, you go to do a course, but you go that first year because you need to find out what it's about. And that's what I did. I found out what it's about and I chose to stay. And then I stayed and then I messed about a bit and then it was time to do some serious work. And when I bloody did get stuck in, I was like, it knocked me for six many a times. Many, many, many a times, man. It's knocked me for six. You know, and you know, we all have worked the steps in our own ways and we know what it entails. It's an emotional journey. It's a very emotional journey, you know. And I'm not going to say it's easy because it's not. It's easier not to do it than actually to do it. But what I found was when I actually had done it, even though I was an emotional wreck, when I moved on to the next step, it gave me some hope because I started to see Stan change. And little Stan finally started to grow up. Finally started to grow up one day at a time. So that encouraged me to work the other step and then work the other step because I could see the results. And I would turn up at meetings and I would share and people would say, Stan, you change, you know? And I, yeah? Like, yeah, you're changing, man. And that encouraged me to keep going. And then I started to feel a little peace in my life. And I was like, oh, that must be the serenity they're talking about. That thing on the key ring, but I never understood for the longest time. Serenity. I was starting to get some of that. And I continued on that journey, man. And I continued going to meetings, carrying the message. And then I started to go a little deeper still. And I started to do some real, real work on myself. I started having therapy. Because, you know, again, as I said, I came from a dysfunctional background, you know, and I went through some horrors. So my books is like this. If you want a stamp, you go to the post office. If you want some bread, you go to the baker shop. If I got work to do in myself, I go to the place where I need to do that work. If I got issues I need to deal with, I go to the place where I need to deal with that issues, man. Grateful to the steps. The steps had led me into these places and it opened other doors for me, if that makes sense. The steps was my foundation that I could build my house on with many different rooms. It don't have to be just one room, and that's what I learned. And it was a magical moment for me because it's like, Jesus, I've always wanted to sort myself out, so to speak. I can remember running up and down the streets with whoever I used to run up and down with, and I remember just thinking, gosh, one day, man, it would be so nice just to sort myself out, you know? And that's what I embraced coming into this fellowship. You know, for me, it's like, let's say expectations are the seeds for resentment, yeah? I learned that pretty quick in recovery. Because I came around and I had a lot of expectations. And a lot of stuff has happened to me that I didn't expect to happen. But it's okay. Because it's the real world we're living in. First and foremost, I am a human being. I'm gullible, I'm fallible, and I make mistakes. That's the first thing. Secondly, I'm an addict, man. Obsessive, compulsive. One is too many and 1,000 never enough. Now I got to juggle the both. And I got to find some balance. Because if I ain't careful, man, I'm going to be like that pendulum just swinging. From left to right. From one extreme to another extreme, just swinging. You know? And it's like, all right, how do I find the balance? How do I find the balance in my life, man? For me, I find a balance through that bridge to normal living. I made friends outside of fellowship as well as inside of fellowship because I want to know how you getting on them out there in life without taking all these drugs. Yeah. And when I hung out with them, I realized that they were just as messed up as us. In their own little way. In their own little way, they were just as insecure. They were just as lonely. They were just as confused. They were all searching. And it made me realize that, okay, yeah, I'm an addict, but I'm a human being. And I have feelings and I have emotions just like everybody else. But today, it's what I do with them feelings. I don't act out anymore. I refuse and I choose not to use today. That's my choice. I love this step one that we have. I remember being in a convention. I don't know how clean I was, but I remember hearing this guy from New York and he says, we have a step one like no other step one. And I thought, yeah, go man. Our step one talks about addiction. And I thought, wow. I never realized, you know. But the way he said it, it made me think about all the other fellowships, and I was checking through my head, and he was right. Our step one talks about addiction. Addiction, man. How it manifests itself in all areas of our lives. And I have been addicted to quite a few things since I've been in recovery. I've been addicted to Bombay Mix. Chocolate. I'm serious, man. I remember I've been, you know, you go through it, innit? Do you know what I mean? And you squash down one and another one pops up, and you squash down one and another one pops up, and you squash down one and another one pops up. And it, you know, until I reached the point where I was like, whoa, Stan. You're an addict, man. Come on. Just be careful. Today, I tell little Stan, yeah? Stop. Stop what you're doing, son. Stop. Like, for example, last night I was at it. Bit of chocolate, because I've just been doing a lot of work lately, and so I've been really busy and whatnot. So I thought, okay, reward myself, get a movie, popcorn, chocolate. But I'm not actually eating the chocolate. I said, I'm just devouring it, if that makes sense. And as I'm devouring it, I'm flicking the paper on the floor and I'm busting the next one and I'm flicking the paper on the floor and I'm busting the next one and I'm flicking the paper on the floor and I'm busting the next one and I'm flicking. And then I said, Stan, stop. And I said, yeah, I'm sorry, stop. Because that is addiction. That's what I do. That's what we do. We tear the arse out of things. And that's what makes us different from them. Sometime when I'm with my girlfriend, you know, and we're doing stuff, she'll stop. And I'll try and manipulate her into joining me. Nah, have some more. What do you mean? You ain't ready. You know, come on. She's like, no, Stanley, no. You know, and she really puts her foot down because we've been together 2 years now. So she knows. So she, no, I said no. And I go, okay, cool. All right. And I admire her for that. I really do. I admire people that can say no. I admire them and respect them for their no. Because I've always been a yes man. Yes to anything. My drug of choice was more of anything what you have. Give me more. As long as it took me out of the way I felt, I wanted more. I've had some wonderful things happen to me in recovery. Wonderful things. I went traveling for 4 years. 4 years I went traveling, man, in recovery. It was a powerful, powerful journey for me. Me, myself, and I, and my guitar. Before I left, I called the NA hotline. I said, yo, man, I'm going traveling. Can you give me one of them where to find things? And he's like, yeah, man, we got some of them. You know, and he gave me one. It was for all the meetings all over the world. And I remember every time I arrived at the airport, I'd make sure I have to hide this. Really, really good. Because remember, not everybody in recovery, you know what I'm saying? And I practice a spiritual program of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, but I had to learn that there's a fine line between honesty and stupidity. You know what I'm saying? Because not everybody is in recovery, and not everybody gonna have the love and respect and the support that we have in this room. Not everybody is rooting us on. You know what I'm saying? There's some people like, oi, back over here where you belong. They don't want to see you go forward. They want to hold you back, you know? So every time I turned up at the airport, I would have to hide my NA stuff as if I was smuggling gear. You know what I mean? I'm serious. Because if they find out, I know they ain't letting me in. Because I'm going to have to explain what this NA thing means. You know, this big ass symbol that's on the book, you know what I mean? What does that mean? You know, what's this? And, you know, every time I went to a country, I arrived not knowing anybody. I would stay there a couple of weeks, a month, or whatever, however long I stayed. But you know what? Every time I left, there was always a big ass crowd seeing me off. You know, pulling my cheeks, the old biddies, and, you number one boy! You good boy, you number one boy, come back. You know? I remember I used the Lonely Panics guidebook just to see me over there, find a place to stay. But as soon as I hit a meeting, that was it. I was checking out at my youth hostel, man. Because they say, nah, you my guest, come, stay with me. They put me up, they look after me. I went 18 countries I went to. 18 countries, and every single country I went to a meeting. Whether it was this fellowship or the other fellowship, but it was a meeting. And they looked after me. They looked after me. My higher power looked after me. I went places that ain't in Lonely Planet's guidebook. You know? And I'm so, so grateful. That's my 5 minutes left. I'm so grateful. You know? And I would say to any of you people out there, whether you're old or you're new, you know, this works, man. This works. I look around and I see you guys looking good, looking healthy, looking well, looking like role model citizens. This works. Big time, this works. You know? They say we only keep what we have by giving it away. I give it away as much as possible. I give it away as much as possible because what was freely given to me, man, I pass it on. I pass it on. But not unto deaf ears, though. I know that balance today. You know, when I first came around, I was telling everybody. But no, today, I know how to give it away in a different way. You know, give it away to the people who really want it and to the people who matter. You know, and for me, it's like, this is my life. This is my life today, yeah? You know, they talk about the 12 steps. Practice these principles in all your affairs. This is my affair. This is my life. You know, when I work the 12 steps, it's not like, all right, I work the 12 steps and that's it. No, man, I am the 12 steps today. And when I say that, I don't say that in a kind of, you know what I'm saying, egotistic way. I say it in a way like it is impregnate me, you know? It is part of my blood. It's part of my life now. I don't know no other way. Dishonesty and any bad thinking or bad mind ways, it's not part of me today. I'm an honest guy today. I'm an honest man. I have an open mind. I've got open heart. And I've got a lot of love to give. I treat people with respect. And I respect people's things. If you know what I'm saying. I grew up in these rooms. I grew up in these rooms, man. And I see the way how we have all grown together into mature adults. And it moves me. You know, it moves me. You know, and I'll wind up by just saying, look, man, you know, keep coming back. Keep coming back, whoever you are, because we need each other. We need each other. And I need you. And that's why I still come to meetings, still do service. And I'm still here today, you know, sharing my experience, my strength, and my hope. And my hope is that somebody or you guys in this room have got some hope by listening to me. So listen, thank you again for listening to me. And, you know, I am moved that you all are here. Thank you.